Accession number 10599, Reel 1.
Well, we arrived in the morning of the 2nd of June, 1940, and from the military angle, everything was extremely efficient. We were well received, and we were guided to the train, and the train left very promptly. And then there were periodic stops on the way, and we began to realise the attitude of the civilian population, which was really remarkable. I mean, they were handing food and drinks and so on through the carriage windows and cheering and so on, and it was really quite extraordinary to us, because one would have thought that we'd won the most enormous victory. And I suppose it was a national sense of relief that so many soldiers had managed to come back. But it was really quite fantastic, and something that will stay in one's memory forever, the reception of the civilian population when we came back. And we were sent to Tatton Park at Knutsford, and there was two or three of us, Major George Chambers and another officer, myself, went into Knutsford. We were pretty scruffy, and to get a haircut, and we were sitting there having our hair cut, and a man came in and said, where are you from? And we said, oh, from France. He said, oh, he said, great, he said, have a drink. And we said, well, thanks very much. He said, perhaps when we've finished having our hair cut, we're happy. He said, no, don't do that. He said, I'm going to wait now. And he sent a man out, bring in three pints of beer, which we drank as we were having our hairs cut. And that was just a small illustration of the sort of attitude.
What condition were the men in there when they arrived?
Well, everyone was desperately tired. I mean, that's the thing that sticks in my mind really most. One was so tired that in many cases you didn't appreciate really what was going on. I mean, somebody would be talking to you, and it was almost as if you were sort of half unconscious. You just couldn't appreciate what was being said. You really had to shake your head. But we had, a fairly good sleep. We slept absolutely the sleep of the dead and on the destroyer. I mean, if there had been an alarm, I don't think anyone would have heard it, but we picked up, and generally morale was pretty good, I think, with most people anyway. One or two would perhaps be feeling a bit shell-shocked, but that was small, and we small in numbers, and we shook ourselves down and got going again pretty soon.
You would have quite considerable losses. Have you any recall on what they were?
Well, we when we arrived at Knutsford, we numbered 250 men and about 12 officers from a battalion of 32 officers, I think, and 600 and odd. All ranks, other ranks. Well, now, of course, they weren't all casualties by any chance, and there were quite a number had got lost by the wayside and came drifting in over the next two or three weeks. But I suppose we did, it was about 170 all ranks that were either killed or taken prisoner or wounded. Which was looked far more at the time, but that's what it came down to.
So you would require reinforcements, and where did they come from?
We got various drafts of reinforcements. We got some. We moved from fairly soon. From everyone went on 48 hours leave, And we were told we were having 7 days, and as we marched out of the gate, we were told it was 48 hours, which was a bit of a disappointment, and we couldn't understand that. But I don't think we appreciated the overall situation in the country in relation to invasion and so on. But after that, we moved to Rugeley, in a camp there, and we had a draft of reinforcements of 70-odd, and gradually, over a time, numbers got made up. Some from the duplicate battalions, the 11th, in the case of the 8th, duplicate brigade, and others from training camps and so on.
Were they good quality men?
Yes, most of them were. Most of them were pretty good. They were all fairly keen. It was later on in the war, really, when the quality of reinforcements went down quite a bit in many cases, and also, of course, later on we got men from other regiments which took more settling.
And what about equipment, Major? What was the situation?
Well, yes, pretty desperate, really. after Rugeley, we moved down to Dorset, and we were responsible for the beaches from exclusive Weymouth to exclusive Abbotsbury, and I think we formed about six rifle companies instead of the normal, just to cover the normal four, just to cover the front, and agreed. I was given the company. I was behind Chesil Beach, which, if you know it, is there's a big area of shingle beach, and then you come to an area of water before you come to the land proper. And they thought that this was a less risky area, and it was 2.5 miles, my company front, and I think we had one Lewis gun. Every man had a rifle, but there were no mortars, and there were no support weapons at all, really. And indeed, the artillery, of course, behind were, if they had anything at all, were using dugouts from 18-pounders and so on from the First War. And it was only two divisions, I think, of which the 3rd Division was one, was preparing to go back, that was fully re-equipped. And it was several months before we began to receive stores and equipment and weapons again at anything like a proper scale.
About what date did you go to Dorset?
This would be about the last week or so in June. We came out on the 2nd of June. We had about four or five days in Knutsford, and then a fortnight or so in Rugeley, and then down to Dorset.
And how were you received down there?
Oh, I think pretty well. The people that we dealt with were very friendly, really, although obviously the war in general and us in particular were causing them some inconvenience. I mean, we'd taken over various halls and big houses and so on, requisitioned for the use of the troops. And of course, we also came in contact a lot with the Home Guard, and they were absolutely mad keen. And virtually every Sunday there was some exercise with the Home Guard, and I remember our padre, who was a marvellous Roman Catholic, who was really overage and unfit, but nevertheless insisted on staying with us. And he eventually went to the divisional commander and said, "This has got to stop. This is my flock. I hadn't got any time to go to church, so we had to have one. We had the odd Sunday off." But no, they were. I like the Dorset people, and I like the Dorset County, and they have fond memories of that.
What accommodation were you in?
Well, initially, of course, we were more or less living in the field, as it were. I had my headquarters in a barn of a farm. But and then, in course of time, we moved back for training and were relieved by another unit. And this used to turn about. When we were further from the beaches, we lived in various houses that had been taken over, and village halls and this type of building. Not all that comfortable, but nevertheless quite adequate.
What kind of defensive positions were you maintaining or building?
Well, we we dug ordinary, normal company defensive layout. In other words, slit trenches, weapon pits, in the course of time, some communication trenches and this type of thing, and did our best to camouflage them. What weapons we had were pretty well dug in. Of course, in course of time, everyone gets fed up with this type of work. I mean, digging trenches all day, it isn't really. And it was sometimes difficult to impress on them the really urgency of the situation. And the commanding officer used to come around, and the brigadier would walk everyone off his feet, would walk around the whole brigade, inspecting progress and this sort of thing. And they often say, the chaps just aren't working hard enough. But of course, many of them were pitmen, and when they really knew they had to dig, like in some occasions in France, it didn't take long to get down. But there was that problem, and that was why it was important really to get them out of that occasionally and do some proper training further inland and change the jobs a bit.
What form of training did you do?
Well, more or less everything from individual training upwards, actually. But we did quite a number of, the staff formulated various plans, counterattack plans, for the brigade in the event of certain eventualities. And I think I remember seeing about 8 plans of the brigade in various situations, and we practiced these quite a bit, on battalion exercises and brigade exercises. And then later on, we had an enormous corps exercise on Exmoor. And this was in the winter of probably early 41.
Were you still in a motorized role?
No, the 50th Division had been a motorized division, and in France, but effectively that came to an end when we came back to England, purely because there wasn't a transport, and we were using impressed civilian things of all shapes and sizes, and the original name still on, and this sort of business for our transport. And it was only in the course of a few months that we began to get proper service vehicles again. So we weren't a proper motorized division. The difference between Normand and Infantry Division and a motorized division at that time was that you had troop carrying lorries permanently attached in the division. And for exercises, we got our ASC transport brought in for that special purpose. And when that was done, they went off again.
Was equipment improving during this time, Major?
Yes. We felt all too slowly, but we did gradually get re-equipped. I suppose the first things we got were Bren guns, more or less up to establishment, and the carrier platoon. I remember got its carriers. And by the end of 1940, beginning of 41, we were getting something like equipped. There were still shortages. I mean, things like 3-inch mortars and that type of thing were always short, and various bits of ammunition we should have had, but radios too were scarce, although there wasn't at that particular time there wasn't the establishment for the radios we had later on. But I suppose as 1941 came in, we had been earmarked for the Middle East, and so possibly then we got equipped a little bit quicker than some other divisions, maybe, who were due to stay at home.
You said that you had a company. Which company was it?
Well, they called it E Company, and then that was a really a temporary thing while we were in that very extended situation on the Dorset coast. And then in July, I was asked to go to the 69th Brigade. The 69th Brigade was the duplicate of the 150 Brigade, and it came from Yorkshire and had the 6th and 7th Greenhides and the 5th East Yorks. And they had been, took a fairly minor part in the BEF do. They were largely initially brought in to help construct aerodromes and this sort of thing. And they were getting re-equipped, and I'd been commanding the carrier platoon in the BEF show, which one realised was really quite an important part of the battalion, because it was mobile and had mobile firepower. And I was sent to the 69th Brigade to help train their carrier platoons. And I had about a month there, mainly with the 7th Green Howards, and also with the other two battalions occasionally, which I enjoyed really, although I think sometimes the platoon commander didn't always accept somebody else coming in over his head, as it were. But when I'd finished that, I was posted to the 151 Brigade headquarters as Brigade Transport Officer, a job which I did till February 41. It was interesting in many ways. I didn't really enjoy my time there too much, I don't think. I preferred to be more with the troops and a more active role, and I don't think, in fact, in retrospect, I was a very efficient transport officer, but although later on I did that in the Middle East on long moves, and that was a very interesting and important job, but in England, I don't know, I didn't like it too much, really.
What are the responsibilities of a transport officer?
Well, as far as the battalion transport officer is concerned, of course, he is responsible for the battalion transport, which is quite a task, and he has a team of people under him, an MT sergeant who runs the platoon, and a technical sergeant who looks after the technical stores and that sort of thing, and then a fitter sergeant and probably two or three fitters, and he's responsible for all the maintenance and records and all this sort of thing of the platoon. Well, the brigade transport officer has an overall charge of all the transport in the brigade, and of course the brigade headquarter vehicles, which I think numbered about 10, and he's also for re-equipment and this type of thing. But in active service, the thing becomes a bigger job, because the brigade transport officer is normally the man in charge of the Brigade B echelons, in other words, the administrative end of the battalion. And he, very often there, some miles from the rest of the brigade or the battalions, and He's responsible for their well-being and safety and so on. So that was an interesting job. But in peacetime, it didn't attract me too much. Well, I say peacetime, I mean non-active soldiering.
So when did you come back to the battalion?
I came back, as my memory serves, late February, early March, 1941. Not very long before we went to... we went up to Glasgow to prepare to go into the Middle East.
And did you come back to a company?
I came back to the carrier platoon, which I'd been commanding before, and that suited me very well. And then I was in charge of the drivers and the carrier drivers of the brigade. They went separately from the rest of the battalions to the port to load the vehicles on the ship. And we drove up to Glasgow and put our vehicles on the ship. Or rather, we thought we were going to. And then we were delayed there for a long time. And then we were moved back to Liverpool. And we were in Liverpool for a month, I think. And during that time, the Germans bombed Liverpool. I think we had eight nights on the trot. And, of course, one of the problems, our chaps hadn't got their vehicles. And they were in the sort of jargon of the time, they were sort of spare files, really, and you know, there was not a lot we could do with them. We did a bit of PT and this sort of thing. Anyway, these raids started in Liverpool, and I must admit there were the other two officers. There was one of the sixth, Dickie Dennis, and John Lowe, the ninth, were with me. And we were living in the officers' club, which was above Lime Street Station. And we got to know one or two naval people. There was an armed merchant cruiser was in Liverpool for repair. It had been enormous hole blown in its side by a torpedo. And we got really fed up with hearing every night these sirens going. It was just outside the window. And then we'd go down to the cellar and so on. We didn't want to. We got very bored with this, and so I suggested, "Well, let's go and see if we can help the fire people." And they were pretty short at that time, and were very stretched. And we helped them, and we carried hoses for them, and this sort of thing. And it was. It was interesting, let's say that. And there was one rather amusing incident where we were carrying these hoses, and the chap in charge of this fire unit didn't think we were doing it quickly enough. And there's this naval lieutenant, RNVR, I should say, we'd lent him, he got his proper uniform all mucked up because of this job, and so we lent him a suit of battle dress. And this fireman in charge of this, he said, come on soldier, you've got to get these things quicker. And he stuck to this for a bit, and then when he said, come on soldier again, he said, for God's sake, he said, I'm not a soldier, I'm a bloody naval man. So we had our amusements, but oh, we were up ladders with hoses and that sort of thing for about five nights, and it was very interesting to see, really, an air raid in action. You could read a paper by the light of the fires. And I remember particularly the GPO in Liverpool, which was an enormous building, and it was started by about three incendiaries, and I think I probably would have been as well, but the fire watchers were down in the basement instead of on the roof, and the thing caught fire, and eventually it was absolutely gutted from the top to the bottom. and it showed really the importance of early action on incendiary.
How did you feel that the civilian element were taking these areas? Did you get any feedback there in the brief time you were there?
Well, they were, you know, fairly shattered, but we never saw any panic. We saw a little bit of looting, people putting their hands into shop windows or the glasses and anything and that sort of thing. We had to try and stop that. They carried on pretty well, I think. It's like the London folk, I think they, you know, everyone was getting pretty desperately tired and fed up, but there was no tremendous loss of morale.
Can we just go back to Dorset, Major? How did you meet the leisure side of the troop life down there?
Yes, we arranged leave. Began to be leave was introduced about July or August for a certain number of people, and that helped things, and gradually that got onto a more sort of regular basis, and then we. The chaps were, when we were back from the beaches, were allowed into the towns, you know, and for the pubs and so on. There was an occasional touring concert party came round, and that was good. And we arranged things in the company area, you know, sort of very impromptu smokers and this sort of thing, and got people to perform. So,
was any sport?
Yes, indeed. We football got going. That was the main thing, I think. And then we produced a battalion rugger side of no great merit, but anyway, we got quite a bit of fun. And we carried that. We'd had that in France too. We'd been playing a bit in France. So the battalion football team got quite good, and there were competitions in the division for that sort of thing, and I think it wouldn't be that time, but later on, and we did a bit of athletics as well, but that was later.
Was there any interference from German air raids?
Very little, really. Once the Battle of Britain was over, we saw the edge of that, as it were, in Dorset, and we did see some German planes, and there was also rumours mainly of various people being dropped and parachutists and this sort of thing, which had to be investigated, and. But once the Battle of Britain was over, things were really pretty quiet. I remember one thing, though, where we were had on a fairly big exercise, and a German plane came over and bombed one of the exercise columns. And I remember the the message coming over from Major McLaren saying, "Not repeat, not exercise," because.